You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Thomas O'Callaghan on the show with me today. He's got a phenomenal new series that's being published in pretty quick succession, and we're going to talk all about them today. Phenomenal mystery thrillers that'll keep you on the edge of your seat. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. I'm happy to have you. Thomas, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
My first memory of wanting to be a writer, probably after a good friend of mine suggested that I find something to do with my time after working for an insurance company that opted to change the way they were paying their salesmen. And after 20 years with that company, I found myself retired, if you will, at the age of 49. So I needed something to fill the void. Another job was a possibility, but a friend suggested I take a hobby and turn it into a way of life. And I searched for a couple of outlets to fill my time. One was amateur photography. The enthusiasm lasted about a month. Then I went and took a couple of classes at HB Studios in Manhattan, which is an actor's training field. And I dabbled in the theater in high school and college. And I thought, well, maybe I'll be a thespian. And the enthusiasm lasted 2 months. So my friend said, well, what do you like to do when you're just lounging? And I said, well, I like to read. And she said, well, why don't you write? And I said, I've never written before. And she said, well, you've read a lot. You've learned a lot by your reading. Why don't you just try writing? And that was the introduction to me as a writer. I'd never been formally trained in writing, but I had a wealth of information that I had gleaned from authors like Thomas Harris and Phil Connolly and Ed McBain, Jeffrey Deaver, Dean Koontz. And I think with all of that, I sort of gained my own voice, if you will, and I took a shot at writing. And it was a slow process. It took me 12 years to actually go from the first time I sat down behind a Smith Corona typewriter and typed out the opening to what I thought was going to be a bestseller. It took me 12 years to actually see that published. But the journey was worth it. And here I am.
Thomas, in reading through your bio and stuff, you kind of came to reading a little later than some people do, and I was a little bit that way as well. What was it? Do you remember the book that just opened your mind to what stories could do?
Yeah, I remember it vividly, and as I remember it, I still shake a little bit. The book was Helter Skelter. Written by Vincent Bugliosi, the DA who brought down Charles Manson. And he was assisted by Kurt, and I'm at a loss for his last name now, the author who assisted him there. And it was, unlike fiction, which I write, this was true crime, and it told the story of the murders perpetrated by Charles Manson and his cult out in California and his eventual takedown. The the detail and the style of writing was just so fascinating. There's an adage that says I couldn't put something down, and that was the case here. I picked up this book and I couldn't put it down, Helter Skelter. And that was a while back. That was probably in the late 70s that I read that, and it stayed in my memory bank, if you will, as an inspiration. And then when I began reading for pleasure and reading thrillers, mystery stories, set mostly in New York because I was familiar with it, that initial seed germinated, if you will, and that launched me into my attempt at writing.
Thomas, you tell this great story on your website about that first typewriter and your many, many bottles of whiteout and the correction fluid. Tell us about that first inspiration as you start writing, and you know, you're not a writer. You had not had any background in that, no special training other than what we all get in school and like me, you know, English classes. When you first started telling your story, the thing that was in your heart and mind, what did you quickly learn that you didn't know? And that's a funny question, but, you know, you don't know what you don't know until you actually start to try to use it. What were some of the things about being a writer that you that you had to learn as you practiced?
I'll go back to that first draft, if you will, of that opening chapter. I recall it vividly. I was down in Potomac, Maryland, at my in-laws' house, and we were celebrating Thanksgiving. It was the day after Thanksgiving. It was Friday. And I asked my sister-in-law if she had a typewriter, and she did. She had a Smith Corona typewriter available. And I took it and went upstairs into a study, and I sat down, and with that typewriter and some typing paper, I decided I was going to write what I thought would be an epic novel. And it was triggered by a trip that we had taken earlier in the evening to a Blockbuster. I think they were called DVDs at the time. You rented them, and or VCRs, whatever they were called. You don't see them too much anymore. But we had returned a couple of movies at this Blockbuster down in Potomac, Maryland, and we picked up a couple of others. And it was dark out. I remember that. And as I sat in the car after we got the movies, we were about to pull away and head back to the house, I watched a woman take a couple of her movies and go to the that little depository, if you will, this little thing in the wall at Blockbuster where you could just drop them in there. You didn't have to go into the store. And I thought to myself, wow, let's set a scene here later in the evening where this woman is dropping off these movies at a closed Blockbuster, and someone is watching her. And I, with that in mind, when I returned back to my in-law's house in Potomac, I wrote that scene. And it involved a woman late at night on her own dropping off returning movies to a Blockbuster. And she was attacked and carted off, and the next visit we have with her is in chapter two, where she's bound and gagged by a serial killer. That was the very, very beginning. It probably took me a couple of hours to just write that opening chapter, and I didn't have any whiteout at the time, but I certainly when I got home, I applied a lot of whiteout to what I had typed.
Want to grow as a writer and take your writing to the next level? Give Pro Writing Aid a try. Pro Writing Aid is a grammar checker, style editor, and writing mentor in one package. Pro Writing Aid will never replace a human editor, Rather, it helps you self-edit to a deeper level so that when you send it off to an editor, they will be able to focus on the meat of your writing and not spend their time fixing basic writing issues. ProWritingAid is the only platform that offers world-class grammar and style checking, combined with more in-depth reports to help you strengthen your writing. Our unique combination of suggestions, articles, videos, and quizzes makes writing fun and interactive. Writing can be grammatically perfect, but still feel awkward and clumsy. ProWritingAid searches out elements like repetitiveness, vague wording, sentence length variation, over-dependence on adverbs, passive voice, over-complicated sentence structures, and so much more. Nothing makes a writer lose credibility faster than spelling and grammar mistakes. Submit clean, error-free writing. Go to ProWritingAid.com and use code HANK20 for 20% off of ProWritingAid Premium. ProWritingAid. Check it out today. I love it. Did you have any idea where that story was going? Or did the initial inspiration just kind of grab you, and as the writer, you had to figure out, you were along for the ride like your readers would be?
Exactly. I didn't know where it was going to go. I only saw it in my head, and I decided to create it as an opening chapter. And then the following chapter, of course, is when she's seen again in the clutches of this serial killer. And it progressed from there. I sort of followed what I remember from most of my reading of Dean Koontz, Michael Connelly, Ed McBain, the flow of things. And I wanted the reader, I have this sense when I write. I want to open a book by inviting a reader onto a roller coaster of sorts. And then I want to continue writing, in essence, continue moving that roller coaster nonstop until the end of the book. I never let them off. So I write in a very fast pace. There's a lot of dialogue. There's enough description in there so people have a sense of where things are happening. But the dialogue is quick, and it makes for a fast read and an exciting read. I like to end each chapter grabbing the reader's attention, and so they're looking to turn the page to read the next one. They're back on that roller coaster. And, of course, I'll blend in the introduction of Lieutenant John Driscoll and his team as they are brought into this case. They're made aware of it, and they're assigned this case. And after the book is complete in terms of the first draft, I then will go back in and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite just so I get it right. Sometimes that involves moving chapters around. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it involves just adding a little bit more. But it's a process I enjoy doing. And the feedback I get from my readers, they enjoy reading it. So I think it's a win-win.
Absolutely. You mentioned NYPD Homicide Commander Lieutenant John W. Driscoll. And I gave his whole title there. You mentioned him just a minute ago. When did he come into your imagination?
Interestingly enough, when I was a young boy, 16, working in Park Slope, Brooklyn, in a butcher shop, there's a couple of scenes in Bone Thief that anybody that knows my prior experiences growing up as a kid will see. In there, because there's a scene with a butcher block, and I can remember scraping a butcher block as a kid at the age of 16. But when I was 16 years of age, there was a group of customers would come into the store. It was a local butcher shop in a residential area of Park Slope, Brooklyn, and customers would come into the store to buy steak and cold cuts and chicken, pork chops, and whatnot. And this one fellow, he had a striking presence. and he, I understood, was a retired detective with the NYPD, and his name was Driscoll. Now, I knew him from the area. I didn't know him to speak to. I'm 16. He's probably in his 40s, late 40s, 50s at the time. But he just had this presence. And when I decided to bring in a homicide commander, I had his image in my mind, just the way he stood and the mannerism that he had when he spoke, and the name. And that's where that originated. And once I had the character in mind, I then thought of, well, if this book was ever to be a movie, who would portray this character, John Driscoll? And at the time, the actor that I had in mind was Brian Dennehy, who is now deceased. But back then, he was making movie after movie, and he had that way about him when he performed as a detective and as a policeman. He carried himself well. And when I wrote any scene involving Driscoll, I had Brian Dennehy in mind.
I love that. I love when a character is kind of rooted in reality, and you can, mm-hmm. you know, even if it's just in the writer's mind, you know, being able to tie that mm-hmm. back adds a little weight or, you know, gravitas to a character. It feels like.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know that you, you didn't, you know, some people, they're kind of, you know, strange when you hear their story of publication and they write their first book and you barely do any edits and it gets sold and, you know, their mm-hmm. writing career takes off immediately. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. they tend to stumble a little further down the road because, you know, maybe mm-hmm. they weren't prepared for all the stuff that comes with it. It took you a little while to get your first book published, didn't it?
It did. Yeah. It took me 12 years, basically, from actually the start of that chapter down in Potomac, Maryland, to signing a contract to have that book published. And during that 12-year period, the book went through many rewrites. When I had what I thought was a masterpiece on paper, a manuscript of about 400 pages, I did a little research on how I would be able to get it published, and I understood that in order for fiction to be published by a major publishing house, they wanted it to be sent first to a literary agent who would read it on their behalf and then send it to a publishing house. It limited the number of unsolicited manuscripts that a publishing house would receive. So the first thing I did was I went into a Barnes & Nobles and I picked up a copy of The Guide to Literary Agents. So it was a thick paperback which listed every literary agent in the United States, and it listed them by genre. And I focused on the thriller mystery genre, and I put together a query letter introducing myself and introducing my book. And I included the first, I think, 10 pages, perhaps 15 pages of the book. And I sent out by mail at the time. Now it's done electronically. But I sent out by mail a query letter with those pages to eventually every agent listed in that book. And it would probably... I'd probably send out four a day, and I would continue until I reached the end. And what happens when the query letter is received, someone in that literary agent's office is going to read it, and you'll either never hear from them or you'll hear back with a no thank you, or, you know, I kind of like this. Could you send a little bit more? And during the course of the 12 years, I got a lot of rejections, and I got a lot of almosts where they were interested enough to read the the manuscript, and I sent the manuscript off, and it eventually came back where they said, you know, I really like this, but. And after hearing a lot of people say it's very good. However, I recalled a couple of agents telling me that, you know, it's really good. It just needs a little bit more work professionally. And I think maybe you should seek the assistance of a professional editor, a book doctor of sorts. And my pride said, you know what, I'm going to hold off on that. But when I ran out of agents to send out to, I said, well, perhaps that's the road to travel and the bridge to cross. So I went online and I searched for editors who worked on thrillers, on murder and mayhem stories. And I came across the name Dick Marek. And Dick was a huge name in the business. He edited, believe it or not, he edited Hemingway in his early days as an editor. He edited Thomas Harris's Silence of the Lambs. He edited Robert Ludlum's first 9 books. He was the ghostwriter of the Central Park Jogger. Huge name. Unfortunately, we lost him just a few months ago. He died in March. He became a good friend. And I remember finding him online, and there was a phone number to call. And I called him, and I thought to myself, you know, this guy's big. He's huge. He's, you know, he's probably going to be courteous enough to listen to me, but I don't think he's going to take me on because he'd be out of my league. And when I called him, he didn't ask me too much about the book. What he wanted to know was who read it and what did they say about it. So in essence, he was using those calls as screens. And I was savvy enough to remember some of the bigger name agents who made some positive comments. But I dropped those names and I dropped what they said. And he said, well, if they said that about it, then I think we could work together. And that was the beginning of the what became the launch of the book. I submitted the manuscript to him. He went over it word by word and sent it back to me with a lot of red ink and a lot of pages crossed out. And he said, "Tom, it's going to take you a year to complete the edits that I'm suggesting." And I kind of rifled through it, and I said, a year, I'll knock this off in a month. And it took me actually 14 months to do what he suggested. And once I did that, I sent it back to Dick. He read it and called me back and said, I think you're ready. And he referred me to Matt Biala at Sanford Greenberger, a literary agency in Manhattan, who I sent the manuscript to after it was edited by Dick. And Matt read it, and he liked it, and he said, I'll see what I can do in terms of getting it published. He sent it out to 12 publishing houses. 11 said no because they felt it was too dark, but one said yes. And that's all you need, you know. I worked in the sales department of a major insurance company for many years, and I knew that every no you got when you offered to, you know, when you were pitching life insurance or car insurance or house insurance, every time someone said no, you were one step closer to someone saying yes. So that's what happened here. And they published my first manuscript, which I had marketed as Night Kills, and when they were ready to publish, they decided to change the name to Bone Thief because my serial killer in the book had a penchant for bones. That was his method of murder. He would actually bone his victims after luring them on the internet. So it was a huge day to celebrate because I got the call from Matt telling me that Kensington wanted to publish, and they were interested in the second book too, which I was in the middle of writing, which they then took and published as well.
The Novel Factory Online is software for the serious writer. With features like notes that are automatically organized, that means no more drowning in piles of paper, notes, or spending hours organizing digital folder structures. The Novel Factory offers clear, obvious structures for noting down information about plot, characters, locations, and everything else relating to your novel. Innovative features like the roadmap take you from concept to finished novel. The roadmap is an optional step-by-step guide to writing a novel that takes you from the premise to final manuscript and beyond. It draws on tried and true, tested theory that lies behind the majority of best-selling novels and blockbuster movies. Access your writing anywhere. The web version of the Novel Factory can be accessed anywhere you have internet. So you can write your novel on the train to work, while walking the dog, or climbing a mountain. Just log in and all your drafts and notes will be at your fingertips. Go to novel-writer.com to see how this powerful software can unleash your creative side. Use code HANK2020 for 20% off. That's the Novel Factory. You know, Thomas, speaking of people thinking that first book was too dark, talking to you, you were a perfectly nice fellow. And this is people have difficulty sometimes with thriller writers and mystery writers and people that write on the darker side, because they think you're such a perfectly adjusted, well-rounded person. How do you imagine a serial killer? Where do these stories come from, and why do you think that it's perfectly healthy to read about the darker aspects of life? Do you think it's, because we get to confront these things that we're scared of, but in the comfort of and safety of our own homes, does that help us psychologically somehow? What do you think it is about reading darker type stories that's perfectly acceptable?
Well, I think I thank you for the compliments. Most of my friends who have read my work wonder where it all comes from. Where does this really brutal, heinous thought process come from? I mean, my murderers are psychotic. Where does it all come from? I'm a guy who is a lector at his local church. I've got a round Irish face. I tell a good joke. I tell a good story. I think I'm a very basic, overall good guy. But do I have a dark side? I'd have to say that most people have a dark side. I mean, we all have anger inside us, and we all have sometimes we have hatred inside us, but we control it for the most part. And I find that the anger and the frustration and at times where you want to say, I just want to strike out, I'm able to take those feelings that I don't act on, but I'm able to release them in my writing. And I find that it's therapeutic. I think anybody that reads people who write in that dark fashion should consider that is an outlet for them. It's a very therapeutic outlet to release anger, hostility, and to do it in fiction. It allows me to actually cross the line, not just yell at someone or write a nasty letter to someone, but actually track them down and gag them with duct tape and eventually murder them. And to be able to do that, it's therapeutic, and it's a craft that I've grown better at writing. I think what people have a tendency to do or to think when they start out to write something like that is they inside them they have an editor that's telling them You can't do that. You can't cross that line. Oh my God, what will people think? And that editor needs to be silenced, because the writing needs to come out unedited. It's there's a little sign that I'm looking at right now that hangs on my wall in my study here. It says, write drunk, edit sober. The idea is to just get it all out. Get it all out on paper. Pay no attention to grammar or punctuation or spelling. Just get it all out, and then and get out the venom, and get out the anger, and get out the hostility. Get it all out on paper. And then when you're sober, in terms you're not writing crazily, you're able to edit that and refine it into something that's an enjoyable read and an exciting, thrilling read. So I think when people read Stephen King, Dean Koontz, Jeffrey Deaver, they have a tendency perhaps to think of the author as being those characters, when in fact I'm not. I'm more like John Driscoll, the good guy, than I am any of my serial killers.
The first book, Bone Thief, and then The Screaming Room, the second book, and now the third book, No One Will Hear Your Screams, have all just been republished within the last month. And is this the first time No One Will Hear Your Screams has been published?
It is, yeah. It's the first time it's being published, yes. It's an exciting ride. It was released May 9th, I think. This is the first time it's seen the light of day. Yep.
Well, first off, congratulations on the new book. What does John Driscoll find himself in this book?
In No One Will Hear Your Screams, the reader is introduced to a character by the name of Tilden. And Tilden has had a tough childhood. He was raised by a family of morticians, and he's an embalmer by trade. That's what he does, but that's what he did in any case. And he was brutally sexually assaulted by his mother's boyfriend early in life, which just really turned him toward the dark side, you might say. And then later on in life, when he became an adult, he was seeking the company of a prostitute, who, by the way, his mother had turned to prostitution because the business dried up. People were moving away from the area where the funeral parlor was, so there was no bodies to bury, and business was drying up. His dad had died, and mom took to becoming a lady of the night to make ends meet. And unfortunately, one of her favorite Johns turned into a real villainous guy who sexually assaulted Tilden. And then when Tilden became an adult and he had his own perverse sense of sexuality, dragged through adolescence from his childhood, he turned to prostitution as an outlet for him. And one of those prostitutes made him relive what happened to him as a young boy in a very brutal way. And he then snapped. And he then began stalking prostitutes and bringing them to what he saw as justice. And after we see his, I think, third victim, he's killing by embalming, by the way. He's taking a prostitute and he's cleansing them in his head by embalming them, but of course the result is their death. And he's doing it to get back at the John and the prostitute that brutalized him. We find this all out when the medical examiner discovers the formaldehyde mix in the body and brings in John Driscoll. And that's where we meet John Driscoll. He's brought in by the medical examiner because there's this run now of serial killings of these women of the night.
And you can grab the whole trilogy right now, Bone Thief, The Screaming Room, and No One Will Hear Your Screams, John Driscoll at his best. Thomas, with all three of these books out before the public now, what are you working on?
I'm working on another book. It does not feature John Driscoll. It features a best-selling author who goes into a tailspin due to writer's block. He can't write. He picks up the pen, so to speak, and nothing comes out. And he's a big name writer. His name is Richard Singleton, fictional character Richard Singleton. And he's at his wit's end. That's his bread and butter. He's been making a living as a big name author, but he just can't write. And he goes to other author friends of his and tries to get some advice. And he goes to seminars and goes to a psychotherapist. He goes for hypnosis. He tries drugs. He can't turn the corner and break the block of not being able to write. And he recalls that he's got a friend he's made over the years who would write to him on his website and praise his work and would sometimes say, I think you could have done this with this character. She was selflessly being very supportive of his writing. And he reaches out to her because he's running out of avenues to try to get back in the writing mode. And he reaches out to her and he asks if they could meet, and they do. And they sit down over a cup of coffee and they talk about his writing block right now. And they're both single. They're in their 40s. She's a thoracic surgeon at a hospital in Manhattan. He lives in Manhattan as well. And they eventually fall in love, and they decide to buy a big house in Bell Harbor, where I actually live. So I sort of know the area. It's always good to write what you know. So the intent is to buy a house and begin a family and begin their married life together. And his wife now has it in her head to, I need to get my husband writing again. So she got that in mind when she's searching for a house, and she discovers this beach house that is online and with photos, and she's looking at it. And it's been on the market for close to a year, and she's wondering why. I mean, it looks like you could shoot The Great Gatsby there. She talks to the realtor, and the realtor explains, everybody loves the house. Many people have made offers on it, but when they find out that there was a murder, a heinous crime committed inside the master bedroom, where the husband killed his wife and slit her throat and gutted out her eyes and then fled, people are turned off. And she thinks, wow, what a place to write a thriller. So she buys the house, they move in, and he begins to get the feel again, based on the fact that he's living in a house where a heinous crime had committed, and he's beginning to write again, and then things go sideways in a very, very creative way.
Oh, I cannot wait to see what you do with that, Thomas. Please come back on the show when you finish that book and let's talk about it.
Great. Thanks for the invitation. I'll take you up on that.
Absolutely. If people are just discovering you and your work, where can they find you online, Thomas?
My website is www.thomasocallahan.com. If you look up my books on Wild Blue Press, wildbluepress.com, you'll find my bio. I'm also on Twitter, Tom okay. O'Callaghan. I think it has a at Tom O'Callaghan with a underscore as the at the end of O'Callaghan, and the last name is spelled O-C-A-L-L-A-G-H-A-N. Many people forget the G. My dad always thought that that was important. And if you go to Amazon and just punch in Bone Thief or The Screaming Room or No One Will Hear Your Screams, you'll find my books and you'll find my author page there, and you can follow me there as well.
Excellent. I'll put links to all of those places in the show notes of this episode to make it easy for people to find you and your work. Thomas, this has been so much fun chatting today. Thank you for taking time to come on the show.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
World Anvil is a browser-based world-building platform designed for all world builders, writers and novelists, dungeon masters, game developers, and everyone else. World Anvil keeps your world setting safe and organized, helps you find your characters, locations, plots, timelines, and maps quickly and easily as you write. Then, if you choose, you can showcase your amazing world building to the world, beautifully and interactively, to keep your readers engaged. You can even use our professional tier to build your career, selling access to behind-the-scenes content your readers will love, and growing your community. Build your world setting in any genre with over 25 custom-built world-building templates, complete with prompts to inspire your creativity. Allow your readers to explore the public parts of your world in an innovative new way with interactive maps, timelines, and wiki-style articles. Give special access to co-authors, beta readers, customers, or patrons to see exclusive behind-the-scenes content. There's a free version to get started with all of the major features. Guild membership offers you a host of extra options, including comprehensive privacy settings, co-authors, presentation options, and so much more. Join our community of over 800,000 world builders, including professional authors. Take part in competitions and learn more about world building at this fantastic online community. Use the coupon code HANK to get 20% off all 6 and 12 month subscriptions. WorldAnvil.com. I'm a recent convert and I know you will be too.